Monday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. The Cavaliers live to fight another day. Just unbelievable shot making from LeBron James and Kyrie Irving over a Golden State team that didn't have Draymond Green. But, you know, Danny, I'm not sure that Green would have necessarily changed the outcome, at least defensively, for the Warriors, given the type of shots that Kyrie and LeBron were making.
It's a complicated counterfactual, to be sure. But at the same point, if Kyrie and LeBron did what they did, then yes, of course, it would have been that way. And so the comment I made during the game, and I firmly believe this because it just struck me as I was watching, was what Kyrie was doing to the Warriors is a lot like what they do to other teams on most nights, which is that the Warriors defended him reasonably well most of the time, except for those transition disasters, and he was just hitting brutal shots.
9 out of 13 on what we would normally consider bad twos outside of the restricted area. Just he was taking tough shots and just making them. And then 5 out of 7 on threes as well. He and LeBron combined for 9 out of 15 on three-pointers. But especially for Kyrie, a lot of his were pretty open, especially in the beginning of the game. And the Warriors, Steve Kerr noted that the communication was down for the Warriors. They didn't do a good enough job of finding guys in transition, and Draymond Green is their most important communicator, and Bogut is probably their second most important, and he obviously is out with an indeterminate injury. So, yeah, the defense wasn't that good, but even when it was good, it just the shots that those two guys were making were just unbelievable.
Yeah, so I was sitting next to our mutual friend Kevin Pelton, and I turned to him with 8 minutes to go in the second quarter. So this was, I think, right after Bogut got hurt, and I just said the Warriors aren't going to win this game because they didn't. It wasn't so much that their offense was unsustainable in the first half, though that was true. It was that I didn't think they had enough defensively, and you could already see them getting a little bit kind of like tired and exasperated. And that was the other parallel to kind of the reversal of this game, is that usually teams have to play perfectly to beat the Warriors, and in this game, the Warriors couldn't play perfectly enough to beat the Cavs.
And I would say, though, that the Cavaliers, despite the fact that they played some pretty good defense in the second half of the third and the beginning of the fourth, which happened to coincide with Iman Shumpert coming in and doing a fantastic job on both Steph and Klay when he was in there, the Warriors 11 out of 21 on threes in the first half, an NBA Finals record for a half, and then 3 out of 21 on threes in the second half. Thompson was not really able to get open at all. That was part of the difference. He is might even be a better wide-open three-point shooter than Steph is at times, but Barnes just could not hit a shot to save his life. He was 1 out of 6 on threes, all of which were wide open in this one, and then Steph 5 out of 14, but he missed some really open ones late as well. And Steph only had 4 assists as well. The Warriors only 18 assists as a team. You usually like to see them have more than that. So while Cleveland was kept giving them chances to get back into it, they just could not hit the shots and score. And then they also really struggled, the Warriors did, at the rim. And I thought a big part of that was LeBron's defense. He is still one of the physical forces. The Warriors were 12 out of 32 within 8 feet and 9 out of 23 in the restricted area, 39%. And really, it's been a problem for them throughout these last two series when they shot very well at the rim during the regular season. And, you know, it's not like the Cavs have some amazing rim protection. A lot of it just was LeBron going straight up. He's strong. You're not going to knock him backwards. He's got quick hands. And guys, just not as much as before in his career, but you just feel him as an offensive player when he is nearby the play, because he is so athletic and guys just have that kind of memory of what he is, what he used to be. And he was fantastic, I thought, at the basket in some of those small units, just making guys miss left and right.
Yeah, he was awesome defensively in a way that was more impressive to me than him hitting his shots, because that is something that just happens. But with defense, you have to do that through effort and skill and everything like that. One just weird but also remarkable stat from this game is that thanks to the player tracking data that the NBA now makes publicly available, they define contested and uncontested as being a defender within 3.5 feet. The Warriors shot 16 of 44 on contested attempts and an identical 16 of 44 on uncontested attempts.
Yeah, and a lot of those uncontested attempts were threes as well. I mean, I guess that's going to be the question now to me is, how does this series change to you? I mean, it changed in some ways in just that I didn't think that LeBron had a game like this in him, again, from a shooting perspective. And Kyrie now, he's had 30 the last four games. You know, he's definitely caused a problem for them. When they have to play a center, he in pick and roll just causes some big problems for the Warriors. And, I think now might finally be the time that Kerr will go and start the death lineup, because with Bogut being out, they have to change up, obviously, anyway. I think there's almost no chance that Bogut plays. We're waiting on an MRI from him after that injury, so which did not look good. I was sitting in the stands today because I was watching the game with a buddy, and that happened like right in front of me. You could tell it was not very good immediately once it happened.
Yeah, you could tell it immediately. I was on the same side, but much higher up, and that was concerning. And so you asked how it changed the series. There are a couple things. One, it was another example, kind of like Game 3, that if Cleveland plays really well, they can absolutely win games in this series. And so now the amount of games that they have to play really well to win is down to 2. That is substantial. Bogut, my assumption is that he is out of Game 6 and then probably out of Game 7. That is not with any direct knowledge.
I would be shocked. I don't have any direct knowledge either. But I seeing the replay, it looked worse in person. Like, it doesn't... I'm not going to say, like, oh, for sure, this is, like, you know, torn ACL. He's going to be out for a long time. But it's when you can't leave the court under your own power, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to think of very many times when a guy was able to come back in any sort of quick fashion.
Yeah, because Game 7 would be 6 days from now.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you have that as a major shift. And then the other story, and people, if anybody ever developed a dunked on drinking game, this would be an example, is Steve Kerr yet again did not trust Festus Ezeli. And to me, that is a major story, because while, of course, Draymond Green is a major defender, if Andrew Bogut is out, to me, he is your next best option at center. And I believe he only played about 2 minutes and 17 seconds in the second half, even though Bogut was out.
Yeah, a lot of that time they did go with just Barnes at center. And I thought actually when they did that, the defense was a little bit better. And a lot of it was just, you know, Kyrie hitting some crazy shots. In the fourth quarter, the Cavs only put up 19 points. It was just the Warriors only scored 13. So they did start to slow them down in the fourth quarter. It was just Kyrie hit enough crazy shots, but they weren't really getting good looks at that point. I think the fact that they were able to switch a lot helped immensely in that fourth quarter. But yeah, I mean, to see this Warriors team score only 13 points in there, I mean, every shot that they were getting just about was at the rim or an open three, and they just were not making it. It was pretty remarkable. So, I mean, your initial thought would be the Warriors are going to hit more open shots. The Cavs cannot shoot like this. Like, there's no way Kyrie and LeBron go 9 out of 15 combined on threes. There's no way that they shoot. Kyrie shoots 9 out of 13 on bad twos. There's no way that, as a team, the Cavs shoot 17 out of 30 on bad twos. So all that is true. However, Steph, again, and we cautioned even after he had a good game, so all you people are like, oh, you're just making excuses for him. No, like, he doesn't look like himself when he has a good game. He doesn't look like himself when he has a bad game. This is another instance of him not looking like himself, not able to create separation, not able to get to the basket and score. So he is a very iffy proposition, and they needed really a Oklahoma City Game 7 type of effort from him tonight to win. And, you know, he's had one game like that, one real Steph game since returning from the injury.
A great point that the aforementioned Kevin Pelton brought up that I thought was really astute is that the Warriors play a kind of a beautifully imperfect game, even when they're on. Just they make some ambitious passes, let's say, and sometimes they take some ill-advised shots. And they are able to overcome that through just their sheer excellence defensively and offensive talent. And that reared its head in this game just because they didn't have enough of everything else to overcome that. And there are a lot of different ways that you can point with that, and one of them is Harrison Barnes.
Yeah, Barnes, just it was a total struggle for him, as we noted. 2 for 14, 1 out of 6 on all wide open threes. And then he also was 1 out of 6 within 8 feet. So, and he was one of the guys that was most flummoxed by the aforementioned LeBron James rim protection. What did you think of the intentional fouling on Tristan Thompson in the third quarter?
I thought that there was a part of it that was valid there. So there are two goals with that. One is to try to get him off the floor, which obviously did not happen. The other one is you hope that it is leads to a lower efficiency offense for the other team. That it might have done just because the Cavs were making everything before that. I think
they had scored on 7 straight possessions when the Hakka started. So I actually, although it's not great in terms of what your expected outcome is, I think he shoots 58% or something like that. In that situation, just to break the rhythm, maybe it helped. Although they did not go immediately to putting Spates in instead, which I thought they could have done, but maybe they didn't even know they were going to keep doing it at that point.
Yeah, it didn't seem early on like there was a real... There might have been a rhyme or reason to it, but it wasn't consistent enough to make the wholesale personnel changes that you want to do if you're really going to hack up, meaning having like all offensive players, including one who was a designated fouler, which in this game was Leandro Barbosa. So they did part of that, but not all the way. They also, as a shocking thing, considering the way Kerr usually does this, both Andrew Bogut in the first half, I believe in the first quarter, and Azeeley in the third quarter played when the Warriors were in the bonus. Lou just didn't do Hakka. So part of that is, you know, in the third quarter, the Warriors weren't shooting that well. But it was surprising, and I don't know if Kerr will note that in case this kind of rears its head later on in the series.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you're... You don't want to go to Hakka when you're scoring incredibly well, right? Like, why let yourself have to go against a set defense, let the other team get some defensive players on the floor when things were going great for them? Like, I think maybe that's a strategy that you're more likely to try when you want to change the rhythm of the game than necessarily when things are going well. That's part of the reason why I was so critical when Greg Popovich tried the strategy last year against the Clippers, because when he did it, they were actually rolling, and then all of a sudden things collapsed for them because they kind of got out of rhythm and had to go against the set defense. But is my sincere hope that this is the last NBA game ever that we will have to waste time talking about this stupid strategy? I mean, even when I was sitting in the stands, the fans like weren't even really cheering that hard to make a miss. Like, they almost seemed annoyed at the strategy, even when it worked and he missed, I think he missed his first, or like one, or he made one out of his first four. It was working and the fans were still bored by it, even though it was helping them.
Yeah. It is a hard strategy to justify on the entertainment front, and that's a small part, but a notable part of my opposition to it.
So one thing I wanted to do before I get into a couple of small notes is just talk about all of Kyrie's incredible shots of his 16 out of 24, go through all of those and just do justice to what unbelievable shot making this was. But before we do that, I want to give you a few words from our friends at Indochino. If you are a guy who can't get a great fitting suit off the rack, Indochino is for you. Those suits used to cost well over $1,000. Now you can get a made-to-measure suit for $399 plus free shipping at Indochino.com using our familiar CapSpace code. Easy to remember that code. We talk about CapSpace all the time on the program. And it's a very simple process. You can either go into their store if they have one in your town, or if they don't, they have a guide on their website that gives you 14 unique measurements that you can take yourself and send it to them. You can customize a ton of stuff, the lining, lapels, personal monogram, anything you want to really, the size of the pockets, the angle of the pockets, the size of the lapels, which I think I said already, but I'm really excited about that because I think a lot of suits have kind of weird lapels. I was glad I was able to customize them the way I wanted. And that's the awesome thing about Indochino. 3 or 4 weeks later, your suit arrives. If it doesn't fit you perfectly, you can send it back and they will make whatever adjustments need to be made. And if it still doesn't fit you perfectly, you can get a money back guarantee after that second time. So there's no reason not to try this. $399 for a custom made suit at Indochino.com, promo code CapSpace. Yeah, so these Kyrie shots alternated between ridiculous contested shots, mostly long twos, and then just pretty much wide open threes. So he started off with just a wide open spot up when Golden State busted the coverage. LeBron James dined him up when Harrison Barnes overhelped, and then Clay had to go help out on Love in the corner. Then he went at a 1-5 pick and roll on Bogut. Beautiful reverse after Bogut. We talked about how before the game, 1-5 pick and rolls would be a problem. Bogut did a nice job getting out, forcing him to drive, but then he had a beautiful reverse. And here's when it started getting totally ridiculous. He did a hard dribble to the baseline, pulls up over Klay Thompson, fading away on the right baseline. Then a pull-up three on Clay in transition, which, again, the Warriors probably could have defended a little bit better. Like, the semi-transition issues were pretty bad. Clay did not get particularly great contest, but the problem was he didn't have anyone behind him, so he couldn't just press up on him the way you probably need to.
And that I think that was the best contest on a Kyrie transition three from what I remember.
Yeah, well, Andre had one late that was actually pretty good, but by that point he was just so on fire, it was impossible. So then late clock, fadeaway two-pointer from the elbow, pretty good contest from Sean Livingston. Then another semi-transition, he drove, crossed up Harrison Barnes, totally lost him, got himself a pretty open J. That was a good shot, you know, under pretty much any circumstances. Then he went one-on-one against Clay on the left wing and shot a fadeaway over him and scored again. Stole a post-up intended for Clay, where Clay just didn't do a good enough job of sealing him and just went down for a layup. And that was his first half. Just so alternating between getting some pretty easy looks and then was able to supplement that by just hitting just about every tough shot. I think at one point he was 10 out of 12 from the field. He finished 17 out of 24.
Remarkable. I mean, yeah, it was amazing because when he's just at that point, he's undeniable.
Yeah, then he started the second half with a 1-5 pick and roll, blew past Bogut for the and-one, bad foul by Bogut. Then he got the switch and a pick and roll on Barnes, blew past him, got him on his back, and then was able to pull up for a floater, even with there was a little bit of contact there too, and still was able to score before the help could arise. And then really the two that I know Steve Kerr would be upset with, pretty much back-to-back plays in transition. This was partially caused by Sean Livingston guarding LeBron, and I think Iguodala just wasn't quite sure who he was supposed to have. Curry also would like get caught in the lane, and so Andre could have been the one to go out and get Kyrie, but just, you know, didn't think it was his assignment or wasn't connected enough, and didn't. There was no Draymond Green back there yelling for everybody who they're supposed to guard, which is something that he does a lot. And so he hit back-to-back threes, just easy dimes from LeBron on those plays, and that was really when Cleveland was building their lead in the third quarter.
Yeah, those were the really egregious plays, and that really kind of turned the tide and were, to me, the thing that the Warriors just didn't have it defensively in this game, because while Kyrie deserves all the credit for making those shots, they shouldn't have been that open in the first place.
Well, I mean, you're always going to give up some open shots. You can never be perfect, but I thought that Cleveland, you know, the whole idea, oh, like Tyronn Lue shouldn't try to run. Well, especially without Green on the floor, I thought that they got a ton of great stuff out of semi-transition plays in this game, and the Warriors' defense is by far at its worst in transition. But these last five shots were all just half-court, can't do anything about them, just tip your cap and move on. 1-5 pick and roll was well defended by Steph, and then he stopped on a dime and banked in a 10-footer from just outside of the key on the right side. Then he drove on Clay through two guys, was kind of stuck under the basket, kept his dribble, had his back to goal, and then he shot a fadeaway jumper from about 8 feet away over Clay, got fouled on the arm and won. And then when the Warriors were actually making their final push, they got within six after cutting a 10-point lead to six. He goes on a personal 7-0 run. The first one, he drove on Steph, took off from his right foot, and it is so hard to shoot just a normal shot, you know, with two hands on the ball. If you're a right-handed guy jumping off his right foot, but he's able to orient his body in the air, probably got fouled on the wrist by Steph, no call, but that tells you how well contested it was, and just banked that in. And then, even more ridiculous than that, he drove on Clay, had to like put his hand down once because he almost lost his balance, then puts his hand down again, and then shoots a fadeaway turnaround over Clay, who's got 6 inches on him. And then in semi-transition, pulls up for a contested three over Andre Iguodala, who's got some really long arms, got a good contest on it. And that took it from 102-96 to 109-96, and the game was over.
Yep. And we talked, like, LeBron had a fantastic game, but Kyrie was just, it was amazing because this is a team that doesn't get stymied and dumbfounded in that way. And like that play that you talked about where he got the and one on Clay, I thought, Clay, my read on the situation was Clay put his arms up in the air. It wasn't complaining about the call. It was just like, well, what am I going to do?
He was complaining. I think.
He might have been. It was hard from my distance to tell. But I don't think it was a bad call. I mean, he hit him on the arm. But, you know, you do get into those moments where it's just You know, and Kyrie is a player who does that with some frequency. You know, like his ceiling as an offensive force is crazy high.
So those Kyrie shots were unbelievable. Here are a few smaller notes that I had on the game. Richard Jefferson still has it. Amazingly, he's had probably four or five just crazy good finishes at the rim in this series.
Yeah, he definitely did, and give him a lot of credit for that. He also was a part of the highlight of the game, which actually I didn't appreciate from my angle when it happened, which was that, I mean, of the Warriors highlights, of that Livingston dunk on him.
Yeah, and then Livingston, though, missed a dunk on LeBron, another play where LeBron was able to stop someone at the rim, and he, you know, Livingston tried to quick dunk it because it was LeBron, and he was kind of scared of him, which, you know, as a guy who's just ruled the league athletically for years, that's what happens. LeBron also, when the Warriors started changing up their pick and roll coverage on him a little bit and kind of bringing the big out a little bit more so that he couldn't take that shot, he just started diming up Tristan Thompson in the third quarter. I think he went from one assist to five over the second half of the third quarter and was just throwing some beautiful lobs to Thompson, you know, just finding shooters. It was really just fantastic. Another thing, too, is that Kevin Love was 1 out of 5 in 33 minutes in this game. He was plus 18, but I mean, I think if I'm the Warriors, I am not giving him that much respect. Like, there was a time when they had Iguodala on Love and Livingston guarding LeBron, and I want to make Kevin Love beat me at this point. I mean, he hasn't been that good on two-pointers in the playoffs to begin with. He's not even that money of a three-point shooter, and then he's coming back from this concussion as well. And I think, you know, while he has been cleared to play, we've seen guys kind of struggle as they come back from concussions. So if Kyrie and LeBron continue to be this hot, I think I would maybe try reorienting my defense a little bit more away from Love. I'm still going to make those guys prove that they're just as hot in game six, but it's something to sort of keep it in the bag as well, I think, if you're Golden State, because Love just has not looked good pretty much throughout this entire series.
And while they did more of it in game five, you want to go to the kind of the Enes Kanter approach, which is make Kevin Love defend pick and rolls, make him defend in space, and use him as a help defender when possible. And, you know, he can have moments in that, but he'll generally do it. And Curry did light him up at least once in this game.
Yeah, and again, if I'm the Cavs, I want more Shumpert. He really shut down Clay in the finals last year. He just doused Clay, who was on fire in the third quarter. I mean, he had 26 in the first half. I mean, that first half was just a ridiculous display by all sides with the shot making that was shown. And so I think they need Shumpert. Smith, basically the Warriors' plan is, other than in game three, they are not going to let him get off. And the only way that's going to happen is through busted coverages. I think the Warriors are happy with LeBron and Kyrie taking shots from the mid-range. So if Smith is not really going to be open, then maybe you give Shumpert more of an opportunity and try to keep JR's minutes at least around 30, and then, you know, he can probably defend better in those shorter minutes as well.
Theoretically.
I think he can, actually.
A lot of his mistakes are mental, including in this game, and so those kind of ones probably aren't going to get better. But the physical stuff, I mean, fatigue is always a factor in those kind of things, and I mean, that's something we noted in game four of this series. So I think that is definitely a good point.
Was Anderson Varejao the most effective Warriors big man in this game?
Maybe. I mean,
he got to the foul line 8 times, although he was only 3 out of 8. He was plus 5. And, you know, he did a pretty good job of shutting off the defensive glass. He had some nice box outs on Tristan Thompson. And also, he's really one of the few guys who can handle the ball and pass a little bit. I mean, I think he has gotten better as far as not making as many mental mistakes as he did when he first started with the Warriors. I think he's grown into the system now. You know, I still think Azeli needs to get more of a leash. And I thought Azeli was excellent in the first quarter before he got taken out. And, but, you know, I mean, I think it's more showing that, like, Azeli, I don't know that he's healthy. I mean, you always look at times when a guy comes back with, like, 4 games before the end of the regular season. It's probably safe to assume that, like, he's not necessarily recovered from his surgery yet. Derrick Rose, actually, in last year's playoffs, is one of the few guys I can recall who did that and actually looked pretty good at times. So it's, you have to wonder how many minutes Azeli can play. And obviously, you know, he still has trouble with kind of the speed of the game. And actually was very ineffective defending the rim as well in this game. Was not able to really get his body in front of guys that LeBron in particular was scoring over him at the rim.
The other thing we have to mention with this game, because we weren't sitting together, which will give me a lifetime of regret for this, is that the Dellavedova Varejao continual car crash sequence was just magnificent basketball.
Well, one thing that was crazy, Deli actually was out of the rotation in the second half. He got three fouls in a minute 35, and they just brought Kyrie right back in. And then they just played without a point guard when Kyrie got into foul trouble. By the way, as an aside, that foul trouble, I think, was actually a blessing in disguise for Cleveland because it forced Ty Lue to actually give Kyrie a rest. And he still ended up playing 40 minutes, and there was garbage time at the end, so he probably would have been at 41, 42. But he had a lot of energy left in the fourth quarter. But then when he went out, Mo Williams came in instead of, and I think Mo is someone that they could really go after. He was guarding Sean Livingston for a time. They did not get the ball to Livingston in the post. If he gets out there, the Warriors should just smell blood in the water immediately. And the one time they did try to put him in pick and roll was at the end of the third. Steph tried to go one-on-one against Shumpert. That's not going to work. Shumpert is, especially against this diminished Steph, is too good defensively. But they went away. They tried to do one screen early on. They didn't switch, and then they never went back to it again with Mo Williams. But if he's going to be playing any kind of significant minutes, I would look for the Warriors to attack him fairly mercilessly.
Yeah, that's actually a weird point of good fortune for the Cavs in this game with fouls. You brought up the Kyrie one, which is a good point. And also, I would argue that they were incredibly fortunate that J.R. Smith was in foul trouble so much because that forced them to play Shumpert. So that can happen. That is something that is a part of the NBA at some points. And I think Lou got put into a better situation because of who was in foul trouble and when.
Yeah, Cleveland did get a ton of offensive rebounds in the first half, but then that was cleaned up. In part because I think that the Warriors' defense was pretty bad in the first half, and then it got better in the third, but it's just LeBron and Kyrie were just scoring left and right anyway. And I just, for LeBron, we probably haven't spent enough time talking about him either. We spent all that time on Kyrie. I think for him, this just shows, this is what he used to be when he was in Miami. Like, he could make these shots. You couldn't just go under and give him a wide open shot whenever you wanted. And it just opens up so much of his game in the pick and roll. I mean, he barely posted up at all tonight, because he didn't have to anymore. And the amazing thing, too, for him, he only had two turnovers, which was even better. So he had 41 points. And those two guys, I can't remember the last time two guys had 40 points in a finals game. I don't know if it's even ever been done. If I had to guess, it would be like Elgin Baylor and Jerry West back in those, like, crazy fast-paced 60s, but certainly not in my lifetime has there been two guys in the same team scoring 40 points in a finals that I can recall.
Yeah, and you talked about the offense well, but I want to also reemphasize how well he played defensively, which was the other callback to Miami. And it was a different kind of defense. It wasn't that lockdown, put him on a guy and just have that person be eliminated, whether that was, Derrick Rose in the Eastern Conference playoffs or various guys during their finals runs. But he was a massive difference maker, and this was kind of like, to me, this was the 30-something LeBron fastball game, that he can be more of a four defensively, kind of like, in a weird way, maybe like what Serge Ibaka was in his physical prime, but just because LeBron is just such a beast, he can do that at 31. And Kyrie was ridiculous in his own way, and it was kind of like a quintessential good Kyrie Irving game. But LeBron was great in a way that harkened back, which made it even more impressive for me.
Yeah, this is one of the great games that LeBron has played. So from absolutely sublime, the highest level of basketball, to a slightly lower level of basketball, we will now bring you the Brooklyn Nets offseason preview.
The Nets are strangely intriguing to me, but it is more as a thought experiment than anything else. And there is a very specific reason why I say that. And it is that basically, they have to do what Sam Hinkie did with the Sixers the last couple of years, except that they don't have draft picks, and this is a much less favorable financial climate to make what I call the Hinkie special, which are these, like, team-friendly deals for low value that have a lot of non-guarantees. Like, that would be the ideal thing for part of Brooklyn's offseason, but those deals might be impossible this year.
Yeah, and trying to get, first-round picks for taking on a JaVale McGee, a Carl Landry type of salary, that is going to be far less likely now because A, teams aren't going to have as much bad salary to dump, and B, teams will have so much space that it's not like they're going to be the only one. So the market price for that dumping salary, if it even ever needs to be done, is going to be much lower. Let's talk about just kind of where they are, how much space they have. They still have Darren Williams on the books for $5.5 million. They stretched him through 2019-20. He actually took a pretty significant buyout that allowed them to get under the tax last year. The only big variable they really have is Jarrett Jack. He tore his ACL this year. He is 32, and he is in the final year of a deal that will pay him $6.3 million, but it is only $500,000 guaranteed with a guarantee date of June 30th. And with that early of a guarantee date, you have to imagine that they would likely cut him. You also would have to imagine that he will clear waivers, so they could even maybe bring him back if they wanted to. But it's hard to imagine that even in this point guard market, 32-year-old Jarrett Jack coming off a torn ACL is going to be worth that much. So they'll probably dump him. And if they do that, then they have to give qualifying offers to Willie Reed and Markel Brown. And they will have about $41.3 million in space to play with.
Yeah, I kind of want to develop a term for what you call the Jarrett Jack situation. I kind of want to call it after Ersan Ilyasova, which is the situation where there would be teams that would probably be happy to have him on that contract, but they won't exist by the time they have to make the decision. And so it's way too hard to decide flying blind, especially in Jarrett Jack's case because he's coming back from injury, to say, oh, we're going to take this risk. It isn't Amir Johnson or Jarebko where Boston can say that with some confidence that, okay, even if we don't want this guy at this price, somebody else will. So I expect them to, you know, to eat that partial guarantee of $500,000 and do it, even though he could end up with a less team-friendly contract than that as a free agent.
Yeah, in the case of Ilyasova, I agree with you. He's supposed to make $8 million next year. I think somebody, if not the Magic, would be happy to pay that. But Jack, I disagree. If he weren't coming off the torn ACL, maybe, and the league has always, I think, valued him more than you and I necessarily have. But at his age and with the $6.3 million, I mean, we don't even know if he's going to be ready to start the year next year. So I wouldn't suspect that anyone would want him for that price. Their team needs a point guard. They could also use a point guard, and maybe a point guard would really help them. Someone who can just create anything at all off the dribble on this team.
Also, basically anybody who can play on the second unit.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they like Reed and Brown, you have to imagine will be back. Brown, he's kind of a fringy guy. Reed, I think, is a decent backup center. He's restricted 3 years of experience, so he's not arenas limited. Markel Brown is arenas limited. Reed is 26, so I mean, I think he might get a decent offer as the backup center, but they will actually have to use cap space to match it because he has only been on the team 1 year, so they don't have bird rights on him. Markel Brown, they will have early bird rights on, and that'll probably be plenty to match any offer that he might get. Other than point guard, yeah, I mean, a backup center, assuming, you know, unless Reed comes back, a backup power forward because Thomas Robinson has opted out of his contract and probably wasn't that good to begin with. And then maybe somebody who can be a two-way wing as well. So they have a ton of needs. I mean, they need two starters and they need to fill out their bench. And while $41.3 million seems like a lot of space, in reality, it's probably not enough to do that and actually make this a competitive team next year.
Agreed, and it will be even harder because that situation is so daunting, and their future isn't particularly rosy. So there will be players probably who are intrigued by playing for Brooklyn. They are in a substantial market. They play in New York City, though not in Manhattan, and that is a good thing. But you know, they have very limited draft assets the next couple of years, and they don't have a ton of talent. So if you are a free agent that is looking at, you know, comparing, like, let's say Jeremy Lin is comparing similar money in Brooklyn and somewhere else, wherever we want to say that is, Brooklyn isn't as great of a sell because they're probably not going to be good for a couple of years.
Yeah, you have to. So this is my question. And would it be possible for them to make the playoffs next year? And the reason that that's an interesting question is you don't really see them. They're probably not going to be in the top tier guys. I'm sure they'll come calling on Mike Conley as a point guard. You have to imagine that Mike Conley is going to have a billion suitors. And if he wants to win it all, there's no reason for him to go to Brooklyn, and Memphis can offer him more money. So, you know, Al Horford, Hassan Whiteside, I mean, anybody who's going to have multiple max offers, it is hard to imagine, even like a Nick Batum or Chandler Parsons level of guy, those guys will probably have multiple max offers available. It is very difficult for me to imagine that someone with multiple max offers would choose the Nets due to the fact that they just are not that sexy of an option. I mean, maybe if someone, you know, Nick Batum just wants to go there and be the guy on the perimeter, you know, it's possible. So, but let's assume, I think, is that a reasonable assumption that none of the guys who can get a max offer elsewhere are going to go to the Nets, you think?
I agree with that.
So now, what's your plan if you're really trying to make the playoffs, right? All right, you got to get a point guard here. So Jeremy Lin, probably the best guy still on the market. I mean, D-Well is obviously not going to come back. Rondo is not really going to help you very much. So maybe you'd say, all right, we're going to pay Jeremy Lin 3 years, $45 million. To come and just say, hey, you can be our starting point guard for the next 3 years. And the reason I say 3 years, maybe rather than four, is Dan Feldman sort of pioneered this plan on our mock trade deadline, which I think is a good one, is, all right, you know, you're not in control of your own pick until 2019. So just try to be as good as you can until then. And then you can actually set up to tank that year and try to get a good pick and really begin the rebuilding process. Because I don't see any way that they can really get back to being even necessarily a playoff contender, not to mention just a contender. So that's why, you know, I would try to get guys on three-year deals who could realistically start for you during that period. So Jeremy Lin, let's say you get him 3 for $45 million. Maybe it's got to even be more than that. Maybe it's got to be, you know, 3 for $50 million. Or maybe Nando DeColo. Either of those guys is probably a below-average starting point guard, even if you do manage to get him. You agree with that?
For sure.
So then what do you do on the wing? You know, I mean, outside of those top guys, who is going to really be your other wing star? I mean, like already on this team, they've got Brook Lopez. You could say, all right, maybe he's a slightly above average starting center, maybe just above average when you consider his defense, you know, you kind of have a ceiling for him as well, even though it can be kind of unstoppable sometimes on offense. And then Thad Young is, you know, I think at best an average power forward. Ronda Hollis Jefferson, we don't know what he is yet. You know, he could be pretty good, but I don't think he can shoot at all. And then Bojan Bogdanovic, you know, he's probably really best served coming off the bench. And then you've got Lin or DeColo as a below average point guard. And then who are you going to sign on the wing?
Yeah, it is really complicated. And what I really like about Dan Feldman's idea, and of course I respect him immensely, is that it is basically the spiritual analog, but also the spiritual opposite for what I would do. And I wrote a little bit about this for the Sporting News, and it is just it's the different approach to the idea of not having your picks. And so what I would be doing as a functional goal, and this again doesn't necessarily conflict with what Dan pioneered, is the idea that they should be doing everything they can to build for 2019. And what I mean by that is it's great if you can use your resources to be a little bit better now, but I personally wouldn't care much about that. I wouldn't make that a design priority for me.
Yeah, and you know, I think it seems like maybe they've turned over a new leaf in the hiring of Sean Marks and the fact that they just shut down Thad Young and Brook Lopez for 5 games at the end of the year. Like there is some hope here, and the assurances that were made to get him from the Spurs, there is some hope here that they're going to just not worry too much about the optics at this
right.
point.
Right. So what you do in that case is you think about it a little bit differently, which is you go to an approach, what it won't work as well as what Portland did, which is the idea of no bad contracts. And also looking for trying to take real flyers on guys, you know, use the amount of roster flexibility that you have, because Brooklyn is going to have a ridiculous amount of roster flexibility because they only have like 6 guys that are on guaranteed contracts for next year. So you use that to your advantage, you churn, you try to get players that could potentially be the next Tyler Johnson, you do that kind of thing, and you put it all with the idea of having as many team-controlled pieces in 2019 as possible. That might only be one or two over the next 2 years, you don't really know. But that for me would be the design imperative. And why you go with that is also that you could then, you're right that the market for getting, you know, flotsam contracts is going to be worse, but you're going to be the team, hopefully, that people call for that, which is always a benefit. That's kind of how, in my theory of how Philadelphia got that, is that it was so early in the offseason, but everybody knew, hey, you can call Philly if you need to clear cap in an instant. So I would go broadly in that direction, and where this gets really interesting is the idea of what you do with Lopez and Thaddeus Young. And so what I would be leaning on, because I think their contracts are going to look a whole lot better July 20th than they do now, and I think they look good now, is that you negotiate from a position of strength, which is that if somebody comes to you with an okay offer, you just say no. You can keep those guys. You'll be fine. It doesn't matter whether you're good or bad. You're not getting your pick. And then when you get a great offer, if it happens, then you fire and you trade one or both of those guys for something that makes sense with that 2019 goal.
Yeah, that's you're sort of saying one approach is just, you know, we're going to kind of chill out this year and still try to get some young guys do a little bit better. I mean, the other option is, maybe the best way to look at it is to kind of look at it through the lens of 2017. So if they don't sign anybody beyond this year, they should have about $58 million in space. So maybe one plan could be, all right, we want to try and get decent this year and then work our way to one max slot next year. And just because it's Brooklyn and we have some cool uniforms, you know, maybe we can do that. And then we'll, if we sign someone who's, you know, worthy of that max slot next year or close to it, we can get back into the mix. And so to do that, they can only sign about 27 million of new contracts that would go beyond this year. And so that may be difficult. You probably can't. I mean, we already talked about how difficult it would be to get good, even if they spend all of their money this year. And so if you're now not even going to, you know, you can only spend 27 of your 41 million in space that goes for more than 1 year, that's going to make that even harder. So I think if they are trying to get as good as they can this year, they definitely desperately need more shooting. I think like Eric Gordon could be a decent fit for them as well. Kent Bazemore, Courtney Lee is an older guy. Alan Crabb is a restricted. Evan Fournier, a restricted, might be a good fit. And, you know, but I think you probably would have to get pretty close to the max for him. You know, maybe just a poison pill, 3 years, third year player option, you know, Chandler Parsons style contract. The Magic maybe wouldn't match that. That would be the hope. But then Fournier even is kind of just, you know, at best probably he grows into being an average starter. He at least can do a little something off the dribble. So your team is probably not making the playoffs even with all those guys. And so then I think you get to the idea you talked about of trading Brook, trading Thad Young. Those guys are both 28 and they have Thad Young has a player option for the fourth year that he signed last year. Brook Lopez does not. So basically they have 2 years left on their contracts guaranteed. So if you're going to move them, you got to move them really no later than the trade deadline this year to get the best possible return for them.
Right. And that's something that I would consider doing. And one guy that I want to mention, just because I'm not that familiar with him, but I think is kind of a lingering question with this team is it Valet? That's how I would say it.
But you know, I don't think I've ever actually heard his name pronounced before, but I don't know anything about him either, but you know, maybe he can help them. But
I can give some background, but I just don't know his game that well.
Yeah.
So basically what happened was he's the very talented Argentinian player, and he was kind of looking to be, he declared for the draft in a year that a lot of people didn't expect. He's a kind of a swingman-sized guy, very talented. And the expectation that a lot of people around draft circles had was that he was basically kind of trying to hide himself to either go undrafted or to get drafted by the Spurs at 55. However, Brooklyn and their previous management not only drafted him at 39, but they traded two second-round picks for the opportunity to do that. And so they picked him, and so there is this kind of funny thing where he was drafted by the previous management, but he had been previously connected with the Spurs, which is where their new general manager was at the time. So it's possible that Marks thinks highly of it. However, from what I heard, he had an injury issue last year and then also had another one this year, I believe foot previously and then ankle this year. So I don't know what the possibility is there, but when you see a team give up that kind of those kind of assets for somebody when they're so empty of draft picks for a guy who was never going to play on their team last year, it's definitely worth watching.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at his stats, he plays in the Argentinian League, which is not exactly the pinnacle of global competition, and he only had an 18 PER and can't hit a three. He was 11 out of 43 from the shorter FIBA line. Only 20 years old still, so maybe he has some potential, but definitely not a guy who's going to help them this year. That's for sure, based on just an eyeball of what he was doing in the Argentinian league.
Is now the time that I get to go through their draft picks?
Well, this is going to take a while, so I think I'll just get a snack.
So they actually do have a pick this year. They have the number 55 pick because of the amazing thing going back to a Reggie Evans trade where they had a pick swap with the Clippers if the Clippers kept their pick. They did, so they got the pick swap, so they ended up at 55. But what's so disturbing about that, the first round picks
would have been the third pick in the second round too, a pretty valuable, I mean, arguably a more valuable pick than the number 30 pick, some would say.
Some would say. And so they have the 55, and a lot of ink is spilled on their first round issues, which is that they have a swap this year with they lost their pick this year. They have a swap next year. If the swap happens and Boston makes the playoffs, they actually get a second out of that. Hooray. And then they also have give away the pick the following year. So that's 2018. They give away the pick. And I think after that, they're free and clear. But they are actually in a worse situation with seconds because other than that potential one from Boston, they don't have another second until 2021.
Oh, man. They did make it to the second round in 2013-14.
Yeah, they did. So congratulations for that. So, I mean, that does give you the idea. I was actually thinking at one time when we were prepping this about how it was also remarkable that they gave up all this stuff and they had no one left from it. But you can make an argument that Thaddeus Young is because Thaddeus Young was acquired for Kevin Garnett, who was a part of that trade.
Yeah, and what was probably actually an overpay by the Wolves to get KG. And Young actually did help them make the playoffs in 2014-15, and they actually won two games in the playoffs that year. Anything else you want to say on these guys? I mean, I think it's just trying to think of how they could use their cap space. I mean, it's just this is the perfect example of like, hey, if you needed a wake-up call for the fact that cap space just on its own isn't enough for this summer, this is your wake-up call.
It is. Actually, there is one other thing I want to mention. So I made a parallel at the very beginning of the section to the Sixers. I actually think that it goes a little beyond that. And what I mean is that if the Sixers let go some of their guys that are on these very team-friendly contracts, and the guy I'm thinking of primarily is Kendall Marshall, the Nets should be all over that. They should be a very active team on that potential like waiver market. They actually arguably might be the most logical place if they could just take that flyer on Ersan Ilyasova, just to be like, somebody's going to want him, so we can just do something like that. It's a very atypical way to think about it. But I'm fascinated by the Nets because of this outside possibility of just basically when the box is crumpled up and thrown in the garbage, you basically have to think outside the box. And there is something exciting about that intellectually for me.
I guess the only other option that they have as a plan that we didn't talk about is if they wanted to move Young right at the start of free agency, they could get up to having two max slots and just hope that two guys would want to just team up in New York, you know, but again, there's been absolutely no indication that something like that would happen. And given their relatively meager coffers going forward, I certainly would not advocate that anybody who wants to win sign there.
Neither would I. And yeah, so we'll see what they do. They're one of those teams, kind of the other parallel is Denver, where it's like odds are they're not going to do anything interesting. But if they do, it could be something really fascinating.
All right, that'll do it for today. Thank you so much for listening. Dan, you want to plug all your Game 5 stuff?
Sure. So I will have two pieces for Game 5 that are up at The Athletic, and I also wrote about Draymond Green's suspension, and I mentioned it a little bit yesterday, but the Houston Rockets preview is up at the Sporting News, and those will be coming out rapid fire since, as crazy as it sounds, we're going to be getting very close to the offseason.
Yeah. Well, although we are still – this season goes on for another 3 days, and, you know, I mean – should we talk about, like, what do you think, what's your prediction now for what's going to happen the rest of the series? I guess we never talked about that in the finals.
So, I think the Warriors should be considered the favorites in Game 6. I think that the equilibrium, which was a word I used a lot in my Game 4 work, was the equilibrium in the series is that the Warriors are a little bit better. But that doesn't guarantee anything. And you know, if it goes... So, I would say, you know, maybe 60-40, 55-45 for the Warriors would be like kind of like the percentage chance that I would give them. And then if it goes to a Game 7, I think that the Warriors are prohibitive favorites, assuming everyone other than Bogut is available to play. But I would not consider that a guarantee either, considering Cleveland, something we saw tonight is that when LeBron and Kyrie have these kind of games, they can do that. And especially Kyrie, he is somebody who absolutely can do that.
Yeah, they can't possibly play this well again. Like, I mean, given the fact that no two teammates have scored 40 in the finals in my lifetime, they're not going to both play this well again. But this is the second game now that LeBron's jumper has been on, and Kyrie has scored 30 now in three straight games. I think that playing Green at center more is definitely something that they can do. But, again, another very discouraging game from Steph tonight. And, I think you really cannot count on him to be at that superstar level. And then you really have to kind of wonder a little bit. I would actually say that the Warriors are probably a little bit of underdogs in the next game in Cleveland. And then, I would probably put them at about the same level you normally would be in a game seven. But, we've seen that these Cleveland Stars have it in them to have a game where you just cannot deal with them no matter what you do. And they're not going to do that every time, but you get into a game seven and it sure is risky when you've got those type of individual talents on the other side if you're the Warriors.
Yeah, certainly fair.
All right, follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Thanks again to everyone who gives us an iTunes review or rating. That really helps us out as well. It keeps us higher on those charts than we deserve to be, maybe. which definitely helps us get some more listeners, or even just tell a friend. We really appreciate you doing that as well. We'll be back tomorrow night. Talk to you all then.